to the second case this morning, Carlisle v. Deere & Company. Mr. Hamilton.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Hamilton. May it please the Court, I represent the plaintiff appellees in this matter, Steve Carlisle and John Viscavich. Counsel. The case is on appeal from the grant of the district court's grant of John Deere's motion for summary judgment. Now, the equipment that is involved here is a commercial-size tree grinder called a Bandit Beast that was manufactured in 1999. This piece of equipment is about the size of a semi-trailer and weighs about 60,000 pounds. It's pulled with a semi-tractor. It's a very large commercial device. It's designed to eat trees and turn them into mulch up to 36 inches in diameter. The standard height for a door handle, such as the one to the court's left, is about 30 inches or so. And so if you can imagine, that's the size of wood that the Bandit Beast is designed to turn into mulch.
Counsel, how big is the engine?
It's a 12.5-liter diesel. It's I drive a Nissan Altima. The size of that engine would more than encompass the engine in my Nissan Altima and most of the front seat. It's a big one. The engine is a John Deere product, and John Deere distributes these engines through various suppliers, one of which being Superior Diesel up in Wisconsin. The Bandit Beast was originally manufactured in 1999. There were problems with the original engine, as indicated in the record, to the extent that in May of 2001, John Deere replaced, under warranty, the original engine. John Deere also issued, through its dealer, Westside Tractor. Okay. John Deere manufactures, Superior sells, Westside Tractor installed the replacement engine into the Bandit Beast. There is an extended warranty that is issued on the replacement engine, which specifies, even down to the serial number, that this engine is going into this Bandit Beast. That becomes important as far as the application of the substantive law to the case. The replacement engine, that replacement engine was in May of 2000. By the next year, in 2001, we begin to have the same kind of problems and complaints with the replacement engine that we had with the original. The engine runs bad, blows white smoke, blows blue smoke, low power under load. Now, these are indications from John Deere's warranty records on this particular case. Now, as a part of this engine, there is a computerized device that is called a performance programming controller. You will see it referenced in the John Deere technical manuals and in the briefs as a PPC. Okay? At the risk of offending the Surgeon General, the PPC is maybe about the size of two packs of cigarettes stacked one on top of the other, and there are a configuration of five pairs of terminals in the PPC. The PPC serves two purposes. One is to govern the amount, govern's not a good choice of words, one is to determine the amount of horsepower that the engine will produce, and the second set of terminal wires is to determine whether or not an isochronous governor will be engaged with respect to the engine. Now, this isochronous governor, if I can again use an automotive example, an isochronous governor sets this engine to run at a constant RPM regardless of the load that it's under. Now, if you can imagine being in your car and having the cruise control set at a prudent 55 miles per hour, the car will travel along at 55 miles an hour, and suppose we come to an incline, we come to a hill. As the car goes up the hill, if there is an isochronous governor engaged, the car will continue to attempt to operate at that constant RPM, even though it's under an additional load, the result of which will be that the car goes slower and slower and slower. If the isochronous governor is not engaged, then a device called a droop governor takes over. And as the car goes up the hill, as perhaps we've all felt if it's still on cruise control, we can feel the car shift down, we see the RPMs pick up, and the car maintains speed even though it's under additional load. This PPC device does that with respect to this machine. Now, the problem comes in almost immediately after my clients purchased this machine used in June of 2002, also taking the benefit of the extended warranty, recognizing there's an issue with that, and I'll touch on that here in a minute. The machine never operated properly after my clients purchased it. Again, the same kinds of problems. Ran hot.
What did your clients pay for this device?
Oh, gosh, Judge, don't hold my feet to the fire on this, but I think it was about $170,000.
Oh. You know, I think you've done a very nice job of explaining what the problem was here. This wiring was not done the way it was supposed to, so the governor... The governor principle kicked in, and the machine wasn't grinding fast enough to make these 30-foot pieces of wood into mulch. Now, it seems like the way you've explained it, it should be, for people who are in this technical business, fairly easy to figure out. That's the problem. Why was it so hard to figure that out? I mean, you use your example of the car on cruise control at 55 miles an hour. It's going up a hill. It's got to work harder, so it's going to slow down. But here, if you're putting big logs in one end of this machine and they're not being ground up, it seems like, as you've described it, that's the only possible reason for this machine not operating as it's supposed to.
Part of that comes by reason of my learning more about isochronous governors in this case than I probably should ever know. But my clients, the plaintiffs, knew that there was something not right with this machine. And as they were supposed to do under the John Deere warranty, they contacted various John Deere dealerships, including Superior Diesel, including Westside Tractor, including a number of the local dealerships over in northern Indiana, Gilsinger's, Kaufman and Sons, Walker's, all John Deere people. They came out, looked at the machine, even before this machine was purchased, after the replacement engine went into it, the people from the John Deere, it's called DTAC, which I think stands for Deere Technical Assistance Center, came out and checked the machine, watched it run next to a similar machine. I don't know, Your Honor, why it was so difficult to figure this out. We have the benefit of hindsight on this because in April of 2005, my clients again contact Superior Diesel talking about the kind of problems that they're having with the machine. The technician at Superior Diesel says, check your torque curves, tell me what the wiring configuration is. My client is literally, Mr. Biskevich is on the cell phone with him at the time this happens, tells him that the EF wire is connected. The tech says, snip the wire. That's your problem.
And they cut it, and now it works.
Now it works.
But by this time, the business had...
By this time, the business cannot survive because they've been wrestling with this problem the better part of 4 years.
Now, when I asked you how much it paid for the machine, I asked you that because it seems sort of odd here that you're seeking almost $2 million in damages. So even if you're right under the warranty, how can you claim consequential damages that would amount to that amount of money?
The provisions of the Indiana Uniform Commercial Code, Article 2, under 2719 sub 2, indicate that when a warranty fails of its essential purpose, that is, to put the buyer in as good a position as if the contract had been performed, if that happens, then subparagraph 2 of 2719 says that limitations on damages don't apply. Now, there is a specified limitation in this particular warranty. Now, that bumps up against the next subparagraph under 2719 sub 3, which talks about consequential damages being enforceable, limitations on consequential damages being enforceable unless it's unconscionable, okay? Which brings us to another tension between two Indiana Supreme Court cases. In 1999, in the Martin Ribson's case, the Indiana Supreme Court talked about the ability of a disappointed buyer to go beyond the limitations specified in a warranty as to recovery of damages, okay, and cited 217 sub 2 for that proposition. A year or two later, in the Ream Furnace case, the Indiana Supreme Court revisited that issue in the context of consequential damages construing subpart 3 of UCC 2-719. And the question was, in the Ream Furnace case, given the dichotomy of those two statutes, do we say if subparagraph 2 kicks in with no limitation on damages, do we throw out sub 3 and not worry about it? That's called the dependent point of view, according to the Supreme Court. On the other hand, other side of that coin is, or do we consider both statutes and try to give effect to both of them? That's ultimately what the Indiana Supreme Court said, and the essence of their holding was that 217 sub 3 does not categorically negate consequential damages. Okay? Now, There has to be a middle here somewhere, because we know if the plaintiffs are successful in proving, and this is a fact question, that the warranty failed of its essential purpose, then we bring ourselves within subparagraph 2 of the 2719 analysis. Okay? And I think what Rehm does, it sets the outer limit on where those damages can go. If we drop a marble in the middle of the pond and we watch the ripples fall out, then Rehm, I think, sets kind of the outer ring that we may be allowed to get to. Now, if we start talking about lost profit and lost business opportunity and so forth as a part of our damages, we bump pretty hard up against the Rehm decision. Okay? But if we are limited to the remedy provided in the warranty, which is the replacement cost of the engine, then that doesn't give us the benefit of 2719 sub 2. So I see I'm up against my rebuttal time. Are there other questions?
One question before you sit down. Who installed the wires in the PPC?
That's a fact issue in dispute. John Deere says it didn't do it. Our evidence before the district court was that Westside Tractor...
That was ruled inadmissible, though, because of hearsay.
Actually, the district court never got to that question. And the evidence in front of the district court was that John Deere installed the original wiring. It's also indicated in their warranty provisions that John Deere looked at the torque curve settings for this particular machine with this particular engine, and that also indicates that they consider that to be a part of their warranty coverage.
And when you say John Deere, though, you don't mean in the factory, you mean some agent of theirs?
I mean an employee from John Deere in Moline from the DTAC, Deere Technical Assistance Center, came out and did this.
But it wasn't
in the
initial...
We know his first name's Riley from the records.
Right, but it wasn't in the initial shipping. It wasn't installed at that time. It was installed... You're saying that the wire was installed later by a Deere employee.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Paul? Why don't you start out by telling us who installed the wire?
The evidence is undisputed that John Deere did not install the wires in the PPC. I think if you look at paragraph, I believe it's 17, of Grant Surrey's affidavit, the expert who we relied upon at summary judgment, he says very clearly that John Deere does not install wires in the PPCs, and that's for one very good reason, and that is because when its engines go out the back door, it doesn't know the particular application that that engine will be used in. And depending on the application, you'll want to probably configure the PPC in a different way. Now, their evidence is that Westside Tractor told them that John Deere came out and screwed with the wires. That evidence is hearsay. They argue, well, their main point on that is that Westside Tractor, along with Superior Diesel, is an agent of John Deere. Well, this court said in a case called Buschendorf that dealers typically are not a product manufacturer's agent. In order for a dealer to be an agent of a product manufacturer, this court said in Leon that there has to be daily control over the details of the work. And there just is no evidence that John Deere had daily control over the details of any of its dealers' work. There's no evidence that it had control over its financials, its hiring and firing decisions, nothing like that. There's just simply no evidence.
Who's Riley? What's your...
It's not clear from the record. I believe he is a DTAC technician. DTAC stands for Dealer Technical Assistance Center.
Does he have some relationship to John Deere?
If he works for DTAC, yes, he does.
Okay.
Then when you ship is the engine or goes out the back door, is the PPC attached to it, or is it separate, or how is it?
It's actually a part of something called a control wiring harness, and it's actually not attached to the engine. It's something that is shipped separately. In this case, Brush Bandit used our control wiring harness and modified it for its control panel. And the first engine was installed by Brush Bandit, the original equipment manufacturer of this Brush Bandit beast. The replacement, by the way, the first engine, the problem had nothing to do with the PPC. There was a cracked head, so that's why there was a replacement engine. Westside Tractor was the one who installed the replacement engine, and
that
they would
a clear defect with the engine, that first one.
The first one, yes.
Now, this one, are there any other conceivable causes other than this wiring that could account for the machine not grinding the stuff up fast?
Yes, at least a couple. If you look at our expert report, which was filed on October 17, 2007, Grant Surrey inspected the engine, and he believes, in his expert opinion, that plaintiffs were not properly maintaining the engine. He found buildup in the radiator, and that, according to Mr. Surrey, would cause the engine to derate. An engine, when it's overloaded or overheated, will slow down, if you will, to protect itself and to signal to the user that there's some problem that needs to be addressed. He also
is that
found
like some warning light would come out or something that you haven't.
No, I don't.
You're running low on oil or something.
No, I don't believe so. But it would actually derate to I think about 60% of the power. So I think you would notice it simply from the sound of the engine. He also found buildup of mulch around the oil pan, and he says that that would also cause the engine to derate. And the final thing that he says is that the radiator design on the Brush Bandit was improper for this particular application. He says that there were too many radiator fins per square inch in the radiator, which would not allow enough air to flow into the radiator, which again could cause the engine to derate. Now, Brush Bandit is responsible for the radiator, and there's no evidence that John Deere has anything to do with the radiator. John Deere is responsible for the engine. If I could, I'd like to bring the court back to an issue that the plaintiffs ignore, but which we think is dispositive, and that is the scope of the warranty. Under Section D of the warranty, the purchaser is responsible for the consequences of improper installation or application of the engine or any part of the engine. And Section C specifically says the warranty does not apply to components or accessories which are not furnished or installed by John Deere, nor to failures caused by such items. Plaintiffs entirely ignore the scope of the warranty in their briefs, and they've ignored it again today. And this is probably because their own allegations match precisely the words of the exclusion of the warranty. They say the engine didn't run properly because, quote, the programming connector had a jumper wire installed between the E-pin and the pin to its immediate right. And then they go on to say, John Deere failed to set the PPC to the proper wiring configuration for the application of this engine to the operation of the Brush Bandit. By their own allegations, their claims are excluded under the scope of the warranty, and this makes sense that their claims would be excluded. Because as I just said, John Deere doesn't control the installation of the wiring in the PPCs. So if it doesn't control the installation, it would make sense that it would want to exclude any failures as a result of an improper installation or application.
How does this Riley thing figure in then? with if it had already been installed, what did he do?
It's not clear what he did from the record. He apparently came out and looked at the engine at their request, attempting to ascertain the problem.
At the request
with the
engine. Of the dealer?
There's no evidence in the record to that effect, I think, and I'm just not sure, to tell you the truth.
Can I ask a question about, I mean, I know that you and Mr. Hamilton probably have learned more about how asynchronous governors work, but here's something that's puzzling me. Okay, this thing is installed with this connection of E and F or whatever it is, so it creates the asynchronous governor and it sets it at 2,100 RPMs and it can't go past it. When you snip that thing, you're running afoul of this warning label, right? That says you're not supposed. It's supposed to be installed that way to make the product run the way these brush people intended their the grand product, the thing that's as big as
right.
the tractor
the brush
trailer.
Bandit.
Okay, the brush bandit. Once you snip the wire, you're gone. You're doing a use that's not certainly not recommended and warned against. Am I reading that right?
You're absolutely reading that right. And if the court doesn't find that their claim is excluded by the scope of the warranty and goes on to address the issue of product defect, that's the first problem that plaintiff's claim butts up against. The PPC wasn't wired defectively as a matter of law. According to Grant Surrey, he said that there is on the control panel of the brush bandit a warning, a notice. It says notice, maximum engine speed, 2,100 RPMs. His testimony is undisputed that it is this isochronous governor, this EF wire, that kept the PPC at 2,100 RPMs. Snipping it, as you said, Judge Dow, allows the engine to exceed this notice, to exceed 2,100 RPMs, which is in contravention of Brush Bandit's own warning. The other problem, if you're looking at the issue of product defect, is that Deere did not configure the PPC, and I've already discussed that. But just to reiterate, when the engines go out the back door, they may be used in any number of various and unknown applications. John Deere sells its engines to a distributor, in this case Superior Diesel, and then Superior Diesel can sell its engines to any number of manufacturers, a water pump manufacturer, an electrical generator manufacturer, in this case a Brush Bandit. Beast manufacturer. So it makes sense that John Deere would not configure the PPC. And finally, plaintiffs are just not qualified to say that there is a defect in this case, that the EF wire should not have been installed, to use their words, in the PPC. They're lay witnesses, and they don't claim to be experts. And as lay witnesses, their testimony has to fit within Rule 701. Rule 701 has three prongs. And they have to meet all of them. The first one is that their testimony has to be rationally based on their own perception. Well, their testimony about the defect is not based on their own perception. It's based on a telephone call, as you heard today, with someone at Superior Diesel. That is hearsay. And I've already explained why Superior Diesel is not our agent. By the way, they're not authorized to make statements on John Deere's behalf either. The warranty specifically says that engine distributors are not authorized to make statements on John Deere's behalf. So they fail right out of the gate. The other problem they butt up against under Rule 701 is that as lay witnesses, their testimony can't be based on technical or specialized knowledge within Rule 702. Lay people cannot testify as to a problem with a performance programming connector. Mr. Hamilton and I can barely talk about the problems with the performance program connector. This is a technical, specialized piece of equipment that requires a technical, specialized explanation. Grant Surrey provides the explanation that the wiring as originally configured was not defective. And finally, in order to fit within Rule 701, the testimony has to be helpful to a clear understanding of the witness's testimony or a determination of fact and issue. Well, if it's not based rationally on your own perception and it's outside of your ken as a lay witness, it can't possibly be reliable and therefore it can't possibly be helpful to a jury.
Did Judge Moody reach that issue of admissibility?
No, he did not. He dismissed our motion to strike as moot because he didn't even have to reach that issue. We would say that if the court goes beyond the scope of the warranty and wants to look at the issue of product defect, it can do so and it should do so without sending it back to the district court. This court can affirm on any basis preserved in the record. And this is all a paper record, and you're as capable of ruling on this in the first instance as the district judge would be. Finally, I'd like to very briefly address the consequential damages issue. Even if you disagree with us on the scope of the warranty, and even if you disagree with us on the issue of product defect, the plaintiffs still have the problem that their remedy is limited. The warranty specifically disclaims consequential damages. And the Supreme Court in Rheem very clearly dealt with this issue and said it doesn't matter that whether a warranty fails of its essential purpose. Now, we would say that the warranty did not fail of its essential purpose, but even if it had, the consequential damages limitation has to be unconscionable in order to be struck down. Plaintiffs don't argue that the consequential damages limitation is unconscionable. They don't even cite Rheem in their briefs. Rheem came after a case called Martin Rispins, which they talked about earlier. Martin Rispins dealt with failure of essential purpose. Rheem, which came later, dealt with unconscionability and said very clearly that a consequential damages limitation must be upheld unless it is unconscionable, which plaintiffs don't argue. Plaintiffs are not entitled to recover under the warranty whether you look solely at plaintiffs' own allegations and compare them to the scope of the warranty or go further and look at the evidence on product defect. And even if you disagree with us on those two points, plaintiffs' remedy is still limited by the warranty, which expressly disclaims liability for consequential damages. This court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Paul. How much? 2 minutes, Mr. Hamm.
A recurring theme in this case has been that John Deere doesn't know what its engines are used for. In this case, it does, because as the court will recall, the engine that's at dispute in this case is a replacement engine that John Deere provided right down to the serial number on the extended warranty to go into this particular machine. So in this case, they knew what this engine was going to be used for.
Let me ask you, though, if they knew that, would they ever have suspected that that someone would have snipped the wire? If you know you got the machine and you know the machine has a warning on it that says it's not to exceed 2,100 RPMs, would they ever have known that it would be used without the wire connected?
Well, two comments in response to that, Your Honor. It is in the documents that you have in the record that what Riley did was to spend 2 hours checking the torque curves on this machine after the replacement engine was installed. Okay? Checking the torque curves necessarily involves the wiring configuration of the PPC. Second comment, John Deere takes a leap that's not supported by any of the evidence, and that is, well, when you snip the wire, you run the machine in excess of 2,100 RPMs, and that's against the manufacturer's recommendation. There's no evidence in the record that the machine ever did run any faster than 2,100 RPM before or after the wire was snipped. Buschendorf, this court decided that case on the basis of a dealer who attempted to make an oral warranty as to horsepower to a disappointed buyer. The buyer then went back and tried to sue the manufacturer of the engine. This case is different because we already have John Deere's written warranty. Okay? This case is distinguishable from Buschendorf because this warranty from John Deere says
Don't talk to John Deere with warranty problems. Talk to our authorized dealers about warranty claims that you have. That's what my clients did, and that is why the statements made by the dealers to my clients fall within the 801 non-hearsay definition of a statement by an agent made within the scope of the agency.
One last question for you. Did Riley look at this thing, the torque curves, after the wire was snipped?
No, he did not.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Case to be taken under advisement. We move to the third case.